You need to say something? Everybody, you ready to get started?
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm Tarek. I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hi, Tarek.
All right, we're going to have a few minutes of silence, and then I'm going to lead everyone in a prayer, and we'll get the morning started. Please repeat after me. Spirit, we acknowledge your presence here.
We
ask that you guide and direct us.
Please set aside
that within each of us
that would keep us from hearing the truth.
Please set aside
everything we think about this retreat.
This illness,
these steps,
and about one another,
and
especially you, God,
so
we can have an open mind,
and a new experience,
with all of these things.
Help us see the truth.
Amen. Last night we covered the first step. We're going to start the morning off with talking about unmanageability. But we started the night off, we gave a little bit of our background, and then I discussed the circle and the triangle, and I'd referenced the three areas or states of consciousness or being that are really dangerous when an alcoholic or an addict arrives there. One being when we get to a place where we can't think straight and we're starting to lack proportion in areas of our lives. Another is when we feel a sense of separation or isolation. And a third is a lack of purpose. Our life doesn't have much meaning. We don't know what we're doing here, and we feel very lost. And now our legacies in Alcoholics Anonymous will address all three of those problems. Working the steps, specifically 1 through 11, will put you in a place where you're at least aware of when you're lacking proportion and you can't think straight. Finding a home group and experiencing the unity where we take our body, we feel like we belong. We get into the middle of the herd. And once we start sponsoring people and we experience the magic of that relationship, it seems like our life begins to have a sense of direction and a purpose, and it has meaning. You know, why else would we go through all of the darkness associated with our addictions, our greatest liability, and not be able to turn it into a jewel and an asset to go help someone else save their lives. And that's what we do here. And those three, the mind, the body, and the spirit, can be addressed in recovery, unity, and service. And so if you're ever curious of where you are in this deal, in this program, just look at those. What's the action being taken in all three areas? Because a lot of individuals, me included, in my first 18 months, I was hanging out in one part of a three-part program expecting the results of hanging out in all three. And it doesn't work like that. Not in my experience, anyway. And then we talked about the physical craving, which is covered in the doctor's opinion. It's also covered on pages 17 to 23. It's one simple question that you're really looking at in the majority of those pages. Tarek, when you put one in your body, can you control how much? What does your experience abundantly confirm? My experience confirms to me that once I start, all bets are off. That's what my experience confirms with most substances. And then we didn't really touch on Bill's story, but Bill's story is an identification exercise. First 8 pages, did you ever think like Bill? Did you ever feel like Bill? Did you ever drink like Bill? Let's say you don't have a lot of drinking experience. We'll just swap it out. Did you ever use drugs like Bill described his drinking? And highlight. And you will find that you have a lot in common with Bill if you're an alcoholic and an addict. The second 8 pages of Bill's story, when Ebby walks in, that's Bill's discussion about God, and then he talks about the process he took to recover. And for me, when I take a guy through the book, it's just, hey, is there something Bill discusses or Bill did that you're not willing to do? Let's talk about it. That's it. And then 17 to 23, we talk about the physical craving. And then on page 23, they make a complete shift on page 23. They say, Tarek, all these observations you're making about what happens to you after you start are fine, but they're academic and pointless because the real issue is, why does Tarek pick up the first one? If Tarek's track record says that devastation will occur after he picks up the first one, why does he pick up the first one, setting the terrible cycle in motion? That's the insanity. It's in the first step, not the second step, in my opinion. And that's what we cover in pages 23 to 43, the mental obsession. And they use several examples to describe the state of mind preceding the relapse. They give you the jaywalker, they give you Jim, they give you Fred, they give you the exceptional man, all and more about alcoholism. And then they give you Roland Hazard at the end of there as a solution. And that's what I read about the acute versus the chronic. Okay, the acute addict or the acute alcoholic, for whatever reason, they have that significant event takes place and they're able to stop or moderate. But the chronic has significant event after significant event, sufficient reason after sufficient reason, and he cannot stop or moderate, or she cannot stop or moderate. So that brings us to unmanageability. So if you take the 8 pages in doctor's opinion, 43 pages, page 1 through 43, and then you're going to take 3 pages in We Agnostics for unmanageability, which we're going to cover this morning. That's the first half of the first step, is 54 pages, powerlessness. You look at physical powerlessness, then you look at mental powerlessness. Okay. So now we're at unmanageability, that internal condition. There's external unmanageability, and then there's internal unmanageability. The internal unmanageability, I think, is what's treated as a result of having a conscious contact with a higher power, or when the consciousness of your belief comes to you. It begins to alleviate that spring that tightens in our chest. It's also the breeding ground to bring back the mental obsession and the delusion and the illusion that this time will be different. Or maybe I've been sober now for 3 or 4 years and this physical craving is going to be gone, so I can drink like normal people. Remember, the exceptional man makes up his mind to stop drinking. 25 years go by, out come the carpet slippers in a bottle, and he's dead in 4 years. He fell victim to the belief that after a prolonged period of sobriety, it would qualify him to drinking like other people. For some of us, I've seen it. I think all of you have probably seen it. People stay clean and sober for a while, and then they think it's the problem has been solved. Specifically, if they get some external things back. And so now we have to talk about this internal condition, because it was around way before I picked up a drink or a drug. I was uneasy. quite often I was easily annoyed with people and circumstances, and I had a feeling of dissatisfaction a lot of my time. I demanded a lot from many people. And I had this overpowering desire to dominate situations, because if I didn't dominate the situation, I wasn't important. And if I wasn't important, I was going to be left all by myself. And that drove me. And so let's look at, I'm going to read something that ties into unmanageability, and then we're going to read a few things in agnostics and look at, I'm going to share with you how we do an unmanageability exercise. This is by a man named Anthony DeMello. Take a look at the world and see the unhappiness around you and in you. Do you know what causes this unhappiness? You will probably say loneliness or oppression or war or hatred or atheism, and you'll be wrong. There's only one cause of unhappiness: the false beliefs that you and I have in our heads. Beliefs so widespread, so commonly held, that it never occurs to any of us to question them. Because of these false beliefs, you see the world and yourself in a distorted way. Your conditioning or your programming is so strong, and the pressure of culture and society so intense, that you are literally trapped into perceiving the world in this distorted kind of way. There is no way out, because you do not even have a suspicion that your perception is distorted, that your thinking is wrong, that your beliefs are false. Look around and see if you can find a single, genuinely happy person. Fearless, free from insecurity, anxieties, tensions, and worries. You would be lucky if you found one in 100,000. This should lead you to be suspicious of the conditioning and programming and the beliefs that you and they hold in common. But you have also been programmed or conditioned not to suspect, not to doubt, just to trust the assumptions that have been put into you by your tradition, your culture, your society, your family, your religion. And if you are not happy, you have been trained to blame yourself, not your conditioning, not your programming, not your cultural or inherited ideas and beliefs. What makes it even worse is the fact that most people are so brainwashed they do not even realize how unhappy they are. Like the man in a dream who has no idea he is dreaming. What are these false beliefs that block you from happiness? Here are some examples. First, I can't be happy without the things that I'm attached to or that I consider so precious. False. There's not a single moment in my life when I do not have everything I need to be happy. Think of that for a minute. The reason why I'm unhappy is because I'm focusing on what I do not have rather than what I have right now. Another belief: happiness is in the future. This is also not true. Right here and now, you are happy. I am happy. I don't even know it because my false beliefs and my distorted perceptions have got me caught up in fears, anxieties, attachments, conflicts, guilt, and a host of games that I am conditioned and programmed to play with myself. If you would see through this, you would realize that you are happy and you don't even know it. Yet another belief, and this is one we're all going to relate to. Happiness will come if I manage to change the situation I am in or the people that are around me. Not true. I stupidly squander so much energy trying to rearrange the world. If changing the world is your vocation in life, go ahead and change it. But do not harbor the illusion that this is going to make you happy. What makes me happy or unhappy is not the world and the people around me, but the thinking and the beliefs in my head. As well as search for an eagle's nest on the bed of an ocean, as search for happiness in the world outside of myself. So if it is happiness that I am seeking, I can stop wasting my energy trying to cure my baldness or build up an attractive body or change my residence or job or community or lifestyle or even my personality. Do you realize that you could change every one of these things? You could have the finest looks and the most charming personality and the most pleasant of surroundings, and you can still be unhappy. And deep down you know this is true, but we still waste our effort and energy trying to get what we know cannot make us happy. And I think unmanageability has a lot to do with that reading. Most of the unmanageability that I experience, which are manifestations of being unconscious of a presence in my life, we'll call it a power greater than ourselves. And when I'm unconscious of that presence, I suffer from page 52, which are called the bedevilments. Are all of you familiar with the bedevilments on page 52? All right, let's go to page 43 first. Now, the big book's very the authors of the big book, they do something that's very interesting. They tell you what they're about to tell you. Then they tell it to you. And then they tell you what they just told you. Over and over and over. Because they knew we were stubborn and bullheaded. That's why I think they played it out that way. So on page 43, it says, in the preceding chapters, we've learned something about addiction and alcoholism. We hope that we've made a clear distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic and the addict and the non-addict. And so here's the test. If when you honestly want to, you find out you cannot quit entirely, which is the mental powerless, or if when drinking and or using, you have little control over the amount you take, which is physical powerlessness, then you're probably an addict and or alcoholic. 44. I threw the wrong page number. 44. Sure. Page 44, first paragraph. I apologize. So in the preceding chapters, up to this point, we learned something about addiction and alcoholism. We hope we made a clear distinction or difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic and the addict and the non-addict. So here's the test. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. So stay stopped, which is mental powerlessness, is what that question is asked. Are you mentally powerless? Or if when drinking and or using, you have little control over the amount that you take, we're talking about the physical. If that's the case, you might be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And there's the question, and there's a trap door. The trap door is the word only. Do you believe a spiritual experience is your only solution? That's the question you have to answer for yourself. And then the next two paragraphs, they start talking about a living problem, not a drinking problem. They say to us, if you go down, skip the next paragraph. It says, four lines down, it says, but after a while, Tarek has to face the fact that he must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Okay, they're talking about a spiritual basis of a way of living. And if you go to the next paragraph, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient, Tarek would have overcome his alcoholism and addiction. Many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. All right, so when I think of moral codes and philosophies, it's a way of life. And then they tell me lack of power is my dilemma. And so these two pages, when I'm taking someone through the book, I'm trying to shift them from thinking that the alcohol and the drugs are the problem. There's an underlying problem, and it has to do with the way we live. Okay? And for us, we need conscious contact to begin guiding us and, quote-unquote, managing our lives. So let's turn to page 52. Now, this is a great example of sober, clean, untreated alcoholism, addiction. It has nothing to do with alcohol and drugs unless I'm still using and drinking. So I got to ask myself, why shouldn't I apply to my human problems or my living problems the same willingness to change, readiness to change my point of view? So up to this point, we're entirely ready to have this power solve our alcohol or drug problem, most of us. Right, we're willing to consider that. But now the book's saying, well, if it can solve that problem, do you think it can solve all these other problems? And what are these other problems? This is the reason I discovered the power of alcohol at age 14. Why? Because I was having problems in personal relationships. Well, let's give an example. What did that look like? I constantly demanded too much from people. And when they fell short, I judged them. Every single one of these has to do with judgment. Judgment's based on my value systems and my thinking. That's why I'm unhappy. You know, I don't want to jump too ahead of myself. Let's see how much judgment plays a role in these things. So if I'm having trouble in personal relationships, I will guarantee you there's a tremendous amount of judgment. If I am prey to misery and depression, I am judging something about my current state. I either don't have something I want, or I'm scared of losing something that I have, or whatever I'm experiencing in life is just dissatisfaction. It's not satisfactory. Then it says I can't control my emotional natures. Again, this has to do, I believe, with judging what's going on inside of me, and there's something wrong with me. I can't make a living. I don't like what I'm doing to make a living. I'm not making enough money. I think that sounds like I'm judging. I have a feeling of uselessness. Very dangerous place for an alcoholic and an addict to get to. Uselessness, I believe, is combated when you begin sponsoring people. Who in here has sponsored before? Have you ever walked away from a sponsee feeling useless? No. No. Full of fear. Unhappy. I can't seem to be a real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these problems of lack of power or my way of living or bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight or colonizing Mars or whatever it is today? That's the problem. This internal condition is why I must have a lot of God in my life or a higher power in my life. There's either going to be a lot of God in my life or there's going to be a lot of crack cocaine in my life. That's the way I look at it. And this is the unmanageability. It took me a while to realize that. In my first 18 months, I don't know if any of you have ever worked a first step like this. I thought I was powerless because once I started, I couldn't stop. And I thought my life was unmanageable because I had a mental obsession and I couldn't be in a relationship because all I thought about was getting high and drinking. I couldn't pay my bills because I spent all my money on drugs and alcohol. I couldn't be honest because I would lie, cheat, and steal to get more of what I wanted. That sounds pretty unmanageable, getting arrested and losing my house and having to file bankruptcy and being incarcerated and all the stuff that comes with it. But then I was 18 months sober. I had no obsession to drink or use, but yet my life was completely unmanageable in here. I'd gotten all the physical stuff back, but I could not sit by myself. If I was at home, I had done nothing with meditation at this point. When I was at home, the music was on, the TV was on, and I was on the phone trying to call one of you to see what you were doing tonight because I couldn't stay at home. I had to go to a meeting. All right, what was I hiding from? I always had to be at a meeting. And solitude was my enemy. And then I woke up to the fact when I realized that nothing about my character had really changed. The only thing that had changed was my willingness to do whatever I had to do to stay connected so I didn't smoke crack. But I didn't realize that my character had something to do with living a spiritual way of life. And so when I began to struggle at 18 months and I got really bored, and that's real dangerous for an alcoholic and addict to get to that point where you're bored. I was bored. I felt like I didn't have a purpose. And here's the bewildering part. Is I was sponsoring 5 or 6 guys at the time. But I was doing very little with prayer and meditation, and I made 60, 75 amends when I first started, but I hadn't made an amends in, 8, 9 months. And so I had been resting on my past accomplishments, and I was driving home from a meeting one night, and months before, this man had given me a CD, and it was one of Mark's, and it was a Chris Raymer CD. And I threw the Mark Houston CD in, and I'm driving home from this meeting, and I am just sick and tired of being in Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. Just that type of thinking, that angst was going on my drive home. And I put the CD in, and Mark starts the CD off with, "I love meetings that start with meditation." I'd been going to meetings at that point for 4.5 years, and I'd heard very little about meditation. So I was very intrigued, and I listened to him talk about the 10th and 11th step. Then I listened to Chris talk about the spiritual malady, which is what I'm talking about this morning. And then it hit me that I was suffering from the spiritual malady. I wasn't aware of the presence of God in my life as I walked through the course of the day. I was just tunnel vision doing what I wanted to do. And it was masked by this thing called sponsorship. That's the only thing I was really doing. Now, granted, that was my experience. That was my path. I'm not telling you that it was a bad experience or a bad path. But that's what woke me up, is I knew I'd missed something. And what I had missed is this piece. So I look at the first step as a 3-part problem, not a 2-part problem. If I have lost physical power and mental power over my addiction and alcoholism, I have become powerless. And my unmanageability is the spiritual piece. That's the 3-part problem. Now, on page 64, I'm going to show you where the big book authors believe the same thing. Right. at the bottom. It says resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more addicts and alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. So here it is. For we have been not only mentally and physically ill. You guys see the two-part problem. Mentally and physically ill. We've been also spiritually sick. There's the third. Once the spiritual malady is overcome, we'll straighten out mentally and physically. So here's what happened to me. I worked the steps. The mental obsession had been removed before I ever worked the step. And I straightened out mentally and physically. The obsession was I was placed in a position of neutrality. I was safe and protected. And physically, I didn't have to struggle with the craving anymore because I didn't put alcohol and drugs in my body anymore. But spiritually, that's the part we're always recovering from. So what happened to me is I wasn't using drugs and alcohol to solve my problems anymore. I didn't suffer from the delusion any longer. But you know, the way I engaged in relationships with women did not change in early recovery. So I had a lot of amends I had to go back and make after I went back through the steps at 18 months. The way I took advantage of my family, my mom specifically, did not change. I still would convince her of certain things so she would do things for me. That's just the reality of it. Right? Was I living an altruistic life, or did I always in the back of my mind have this little guy that was he kept score? Right? That guy was there in early recovery. If I do this for you, I'm going to make a mental note and you're going to do something for me later on. And if you forget, I'll remind you. Right? These are things about my character that had not been addressed at all. Because the spiritual part of our illness, we recover in layers. We recover in layers. And that's why I think it's important to submit to this way of working these steps on a regular basis for me. I'm not saying everybody in here needs to do that. But when I submit every year to the process, I do it for one reason. It's a form of surrender for me. That's it. And I become a more effective sponsor because I can bring current experience to the next sponsees down the line. So right now, I worked the steps last March. And I imagine that God's going to move me into a new piece of work here pretty soon. But everything I've been doing since last March, when I talk about step work with the guys I sponsor, is referencing just a year-old experience. I'm not referencing a 10-year-old experience. And that's the way we look at this first step. That's the conclusion of the first step. The my first step experience will drive everything that happens in the remainder of the steps. Each step is a surrender in itself, but it's all of the willingness I have is based on me seeing death in the first step. Right? Death in the first step. So that's the conclusion of step one. I'm going to turn it over to my buddy Mike, and he's going to take us somewhere else. Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How we doing, all right?
All right.
So we've covered a lot. We've covered a lot in step one. If you got your big book, open your big book to page 44. If I'm not talking loud enough, tell me. So we've gathered some vital information about ourselves, right? Vital. What step one does, it separates the men from the boys, the girls from the women. Separates the mad dog from the cool people. Based on some very definite information. And I'm just going to go through pieces of this. On your own, you can go through, read it, highlight, underline, do what you want to do with it. But for the sake of time, to push off into the second step, what we've seen is top of 44 says, we hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, or the addict and the non-addict. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, what is that?
They stop.
No. What is that?
Absence of.
When you can't quit entirely. Obsession. You go into one of those joints, right? One of those joints is a treatment program or a penitentiary cell, right? And you got some distance between you and whatever it is that chooses you. I'm a believer that the real guy, the mad dog, you lose power of choice. There comes a time when you cross the line that you don't, and you hear it in meetings all the time, I chose not to get loaded today. Well, I lost power of choice. After the age of 17, Heron came looking for me and took me with it, whether I wanted to go or not. I crossed the line where this stuff that I'm beginning to read now is true for me, still true for me today. So what I just talked about was the obsession, when I want to quit and I can't. Meaning I make a firm resolution, a firm decision, I'm not going to do it again, and in an hour I'm loaded again. Or a day later I'm standing in front of a liquor store wondering how I got there. The obsession. We talked about it somewhat in the second half of the first half of the first step. The disease centers in my mind. But it centers in my mind as a result of the spiritual separation from God. I'm not a guy that believes the spirit gets sick. The book uses malady. 12 steps of kindergarten stuff. The book urges you to move into spirit world living, fourth dimension stuff. See what religious people are about. There's another dimension that must be explored. That's why you see us sitting here with all types of books, different experiences on a certain level, but basics that we agree on. Are you in the club or out of the club? If you're in the club, this stuff is true for you. When you want to quit entirely, you can't. Or if when drinking or using, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic or probably addict. Why did it say probably? Because it didn't suffice for somebody else to tell me something was wrong with me. Somebody told me very young in my life, something's wrong with you. My brother used to say, what's wrong with you? You're a punk? Just stop. Because he just stopped. But what happened as a result of getting to this book, I found out I wasn't like him. Everybody that you sit in a meeting with is not like you. Some can just take it or leave it alone. Some is there for a sufficient reason. They have not picked up and they will never pick up again. Somebody in that meeting don't need a sponsor to stay stopped. Making money is enough for them. The relationship that they're in now is enough for them. But there's this person that I address, man. And this person is this man or this woman that regardless of what he does, where he goes, what happens in his life, his buddy always finds him and takes him with him. And this is the criteria to nail that obsession and allergy. And the book says, Mike D didn't say it, the book says it, if I'm alcoholic or I'm addict of the hopeless variety, I'm only doomed to an alcoholic or an addict death or live on a spiritual basis. That's my only two alternatives. So if I cop to the fact that I have the allergy, I have the obsession, and I have a spiritual separation from God, why do you say separation, Mike? Because in another book they say God is spirit and those that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And if God is who he say he is, he don't get sick. He don't have a malady. I don't know why they used it. This has come from my experience over the years of being in recovery and research and reading and personal relationship and spiritual teaching. So my deal is that my spirit gets separated from the spirit that birthed me into existence. And I become altered. And one of the ways, not the only way I become altered, T talked about it, 52 talks about a bunch of them. 151, last paragraph, talks about four of them. Page 18, first paragraph, talks about another spiritual separation from God. Being who I am. What does that mean? Being who I am, I live in a powerless state without God. There's absolute necessity if I'm to live, not drink or not use. To live, I must get back home. I must get back to the power. So what's happened for me is that I've seen that the 12-step process, which is not a process I can work, by the way, it's a process where I must let the steps work me. Meaning, when I'm faced with powerlessness, I don't run. I pull into the experience. I ask God in the experience to have its way with me, but keep me in it. And after you do it long enough, in the beginning it might be terrifying. But if you do it long enough, you will welcome the experience because you know at the other end of the experience, you will come out of it a much better person. To do what? Only one thing. To be there when I sit down at a table and we have a conversation and I can help you. That's it. That's it. So I can be God's messenger. That's it. So for me, this is about an acquisition of power, and I have two choices. I can either do it or not do it. I can die an alcoholic addict death, or I can begin to live on a spiritual basis as directed by God. So where's confirmation of that, that this is about acquisition of power? On page 45, top of the page, it says, lack of power, that is my dilemma. Don't say drugs and alcohol. Crack cocaine. Don't say the old lady. Don't say the kids. It says lack of power is my dilemma. So what am I after? I'm after getting some power in my life so I can live. With that comes the separation for me from drugs and alcohol. Because I begin to rely on God as opposed to relying on this finite, infinite mind. And he begins to do exactly what I asked him to do. So it's a process. First step, I lay my foundation. I find out specifically what my problem is. And when you get a clear, entrenched first step, you find out, as a result of the second half of the first step, that your problem is not drugs and alcohol. You got a living problem. You don't know how to live. With drugs or without drugs. Dollar to a donut. Some of the same stuff that went on in your life when you were drinking and using is going on in your life with no drugs or alcohol. Dollar to a donut, if you're honest. So I need power to live. And it goes on to tell me on 45, it says, we had to find, and I change the words up sometimes, I have to find a power by which I can live, and it had to be a power greater than myself. So here comes another little piece in here. Another little piece is that there's an inclination here that I got some kind of power. Because if it says a power greater than me, what is it implying? What is it implying?
That you have some power.
And I'm a power. You know the problem with it? I don't know what to do with that fucking power. I misuse it. I abuse it. I take advantage of it. I use it for my own personal gain. I'm not an asset to the world. I'm not an asset to my fellows. But most of all, I'm not an asset to myself. And I need a power greater than myself to show me how to use power effectively. And that's what the steps have been about for me. the acquisition of power, and how to use it effectively. So that when I leave this physical form, somebody will say, he wasn't a bad guy. You know what? He was I'm just going to be me with y'all. All right? He was a motherfucker at one time. And my God, something happened. Something happened to him. And they'll look at me in that physical form, in that casket, and say, God bless you, man. You leave a legacy here. What happens is that you get recreated. That's what this process has been for me. You get recreated from the inside out. Morals, values, the whole gamut. So they begin to say to us, lack of power is my dilemma. I have to find it, obviously, but where and how am I to find this power? Second step is the meat of the 12 steps for me. The first 9 steps. Second step. Steps 10, 11, and 12 is the milk and honey of the recovery process. But step 2 is the meat of this whole deal. Because I must begin to cultivate a relationship with the power greater than myself. I don't care what you call it, what name you use. If I work with you, I might. But it's of absolute necessity that you relinquish the control and you become willing to buy in to there's something that can help me reshape and reformulate my life. But I must first take a look at what is it that I bring with me to this second step. And that's what the next paragraph talks about. It says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main objective is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. What's my problem?
You're your problem.
What's my problem?
Why are you
telling me, addicts and alcoholics. We just said it. What's my dilemma?
Lack of power.
That's my problem. All the answers is right here. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to make nothing up. The book gives you everything that you need. It just told me in the preceding lines before what my problem is. And how long? 2-3 minutes? Somebody forgot. That's my dilemma. That's my dilemma. I don't have the power to think straight. I don't have the power to stay intact with the power. So I begin a practice. And the practice for me years ago was an exercise called, what do you think about God? How do you think about God? And we come to recovery with some fixed ideas as to who the God guy is. And it's two types of us in here. There's the atheist. Anybody not believe in God here?
Mike.
You don't believe in God? Okay, that's good. I sat in a meeting in New York with a guy in a meeting that had 7-8 years in recovery, and he was an atheist. He had a hell of a story. I actually went up to him and said, thank you for sharing. Because that does not mean you cannot get what we have. It means it's possible for you too. All you have to do is stay on the journey. Then there's the agnostic. How many agnostics here? You believe there's a God, but you just don't believe he's going to do nothing for you. Or he ain't going to work in your life. Every one of you should be raising your hand. Everyone.
I understand.
I'm going to explain. An agnostic believes there is a God, but he's not going to do nothing for me. And how do you confirm that, Mike? By the way you live your life. The decisions that you make in your life, when sometimes you should just be still and you take action. And the ironic part about that is that this area or this situation in your life, you've been taking action in the way you've been taking it for eons, and it ain't never worked, and you'll try it again. Why don't you try God? So the agnostic has an idea that there is God, but he ain't willing to trust. He ain't willing to believe. In that other little book that's talked about, it says, "Be still and know that I'm God." That's not an attribute of the addict and the alcoholic. We don't be still. I've got to do something. That's proof of my agnosticism. When I'm not willing to believe that God can fix this, so I go about fixing it. And like I said, I always fuck it up. But I'm going to try it again. So, how do you get to that place? It tells me how in this next paragraph. Those of you that have your workbooks that you got from me, in step two, there's that exercise, how do I think about God? And it gives you, talks about your current conception of God and how you can find out what it is. And this next paragraph talks about how have I neatly evaded and ignored the God idea? How have I put God on the shelf and relied on what I think I know? Any honest doubt and prejudice concerning God? You went to God and you asked him to do something for you and he didn't do it, so he ain't happening. I ain't hanging out with you. They told me if I came to you and asked you for what I wanted, you'd give it to me, and you didn't give it to me, so I'm not happening. How and why have I been violently anti-religious? All religious people ain't bad. It's a bunch of hypocrites, some of them. But some of them have truly tapped into a power greater than themselves. What do you think about that? You ever met any? I did. First 8 years of my life. Mm-hmm. Spiritual people. They had a personal relationship with God. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. What must I first believe, though? I must first believe that I'm a sinner. If I keep doing the same thing over and over and I keep getting the same results, something's wrong with that picture. Especially when the results are not healthy, prosperous, and advantageous to my living life. Something's wrong with that. Here we get an opportunity to take another look. And what happens is on 47, they give us an opportunity to, if you have any beliefs in God whatsoever, to hold on to them. But because of the necessity of aligning myself with a power greater than myself, I can take all that negative, unworthy stuff and move it into a place of being willing to believe. For instance, anybody believe in a punching God? Be honest. Come on, this is your retreat. This ain't mine. I did this a number of times. Anybody believe in a punishing God?
What's that mean?
That if you do something wrong, he's gone.
Punishing?
Yeah.
Yes.
If you do something wrong, he's going to do you.
Yeah.
I used to.
Grew up with that.
I was like.
Grew up with that.
Yeah,
grew up with that. I did. If I didn't walk the straight and narrow, they had a little saying in that church, if you don't walk the straight and narrow, you're going to hell. Well, I guess at the age of 12, I was going to hell. Did a piece of work, actually did this assignment for the very first time. And the young man that gave me this assignment said to me, "Tell me anybody that you know that can walk the straight and narrow." Everybody falls short. So it began to alter my conception of God. Some of that stuff from that little church I had to shed. Second step gives me an opportunity to shed stuff. become in alignment, to become willing to believe that, yeah, there's some help for me. I was talking to somebody this morning, and we were talking about in treatment, when I went into treatment, I shoot a dope for the rest of my life. I didn't know there was a way out. Where I come from, you die from shooting dope, untreated alcoholism, stabbed up, shot up, penitentiary, something. You don't make it out. Went into treatment for the last time because of a case, not to stop using drugs. I caught a case and had a bright idea. The teacher showed up in treatment. And my life was at a place where I was desperate and destitute. And I listened. My life has never been the same since then. Abandoned myself to him. And as I began to move through the work, my life began changed as a willingness to surrender, to follow directions. And I say the second step is the meat of this deal for me, because it began to align me with a power greater than myself and the God understanding and consciousness that I never thought was possible for me. And somebody in here this morning, you just like me. You got some fixed ideas about God that block you. And I would do the exercise, but for the sake of time, we're not going to do the exercise. But I'm going to admonish you and direct you on your own. Sit down, top of the paper, write, how do I think about God? Go through these bullet points in the workbook, or go through what it talks about on 45, and ask yourself, do you have any honest doubt and prejudice against God? I had a bunch. And it blocked me from hanging out and believing God could do for me what he did for everybody else that on a certain level was a lot freer than me. And it catapulted my life to another dimension. 47 gives me the option to live in a place of being willing to believe. 47 says, do I now believe, or am I willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or he is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. So what's going on? I'm building a spiritual structure. In third step, they're going to talk about the artwork. In step one, you laid the foundation. You're brought into the fact of, I got a problem. What's the problem? I have an allergy, I have an obsession, I have spiritual separation from God. If something don't happen here, I'm a dead man or a dead woman. I got to find some power. Can't be the room, can't be my sponsor, can't be my kids, can't be my marriage. Talking to the mad dog. For some of y'all, some of that stuff works. It's enough to keep you stopped. For somebody in there, that ain't enough. This is about you and your life. And I buy in. We just come to sell you stuff, that's all. We salesmen. That's all we are. Then we leave it up to you whether you buy. The unfortunate part about it is that the majority of people that come to see us don't buy it. You said to me, how many people do you hear talk about steps 10, 11, and 12? World of the Spirit stuff. Personal relationship with God. Spirit world living. How many people? Not that many for me. A lot of people in our lineage do. Not the majority. Because they never get there. Steps 1 through 9 suffices for them. I need power to live. I need power to be effective. Effective in what? In helping you. I've been getting a purpose for my life the same way I had a purpose in the street. And God begins to reveal to me who it is that I need to be. Not what I need to do, who I need to be. And in that, I know what the next step is to do, the next right thing. And for me, it's come as a result of this second step. And a cultivation and an alignment with power. Real power. Not poop butt power. Real power. The power that spins the earth on its axis daily. And causes night to come to day and day to go to night. That power. My belief, though, that might be stuff. And it all started here. And it started with a willingness to believe, which was a willingness to have faith. And as a result of a willingness to have faith, I looked up one day and I had some faith. I had more faith than I started with. And then I had a bishop in my life that asked me one day, "Are you a knower of God? Do you know God?" And I had been doing this long enough to know that I knew God on a personal level. I didn't know everything about him, but I knew he was capable of doing what needed to be done in my life, in any area of my life. And I became willing to take any area of my life to that power and be still long enough to let him work. So very crucial, pertinent piece in recovery for me. Second step. Moving from being willing to believe to cultivating a belief and a knowingness about God where you relinquish the will of wanting to be in charge. Because you become thoroughly convinced with you in charge, you run into brick walls. I don't care how long you stay. People say, "Why are you still here?" I still do my recovery the same way I did the first 2 years I got clean. I go to meetings during the week. I sponsor a bunch of people. I have service commitments in Cocaine Anonymous. And I carry a message in meetings and all around the world. I treat my body, my mind, and my spirit. So, can you do that? No. There's a part in the book that says you're beyond human aid. So that means there's nothing no human can do for me. It's an identification process. We find out we're not alone. What I do in recovery are thank yous to God for keeping me and this gift of life he's given me. And it's come as a result of this second step. Miraculous stuff. So do you believe or are you willing to believe? Then it pushes you over here. On 53 it says, "When I became alcoholic or I became addicts, crushed by self-imposed crises." What's that self-imposed crisis? Step one. Self-imposed. I set me up. Ain't nobody do nothing to me. Ain't nobody tied me down and stood no spike in my arm. I did it to me. Self-imposed. That's the key to freedom, too. You'll see that in step four. We'll talk about it later. That my troubles are of my own making. I said it to you a couple times now. I love heroin. I am absolutely, positively, without a shadow of a doubt, I know my experience with heroin was meant to be. And God brought me through that for a reason. Why? Very simple. I keep it very simple. To be here with you men and women today. That's it. And share my experience, strength, and hope with somebody in here that wants to hear it. And believe that if I got 31 years, you can get 31 years. To believe that 31 years means 31 years, but tomorrow I could be loaded on a rooftop or in a basement just that quick. There's a process that I must go through And that process began in the first step, buying in, and in the second step, becoming willing to believe. 53 says, I had to fiercely face the proposition that God either is or else he is nothing. He's everything or he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was my choice to be? So another little piece. Does everything entail nothing? Does everything entail nothing? Somebody. Talk to me. Your workshop. Does everything entail nothing? Everything entail nothing? Just say what you're saying. Yes, no, maybe no. So. No.
No.
Everything entail nothing? Huh? No. Everything entail nothing.
Honestly,
huh?
Yes.
What?
I'm just looking for that answer. looks like
you're
looking for that answer.
I already know the answer. I want to know if you know.
Oh, no, I just, you know.
The book says, and I think it's a trap door. See, the process in the book, Bill and Bob put a bunch of trap doors in here for the poopies to get out. You know, like go over to the nearest bar and try some controlled drinking. That's a trap door. For the guy that don't really want to do this. When I got to that, it was like, hell no. I'm not going to find a cop man and shoot no more dope. No. Does everything entail nothing?
I'm going to say yes. Yeah. I'm going to say yes.
What's the number line start at?
Yes.
What's the number? Huh? Number line starts at zero, right, or one?
Yes.
Nothing.
So does everything entail nothing?
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Everything entails nothing.
Or includes nothing. Does everything include nothing?
Includes nothing.
Everything entails nothing.
Number line starts at what?
Zero.
Zero, one, two, three, four, five. Right? Right. So what was given to you, Mike? That from now on, when you think God ain't in the experience, he's there. In the argument or the fight with the wife, he's there. God is trying to show you something. He's trying to teach you something about you.
Yeah.
I must find him. I must find him. You with me?
Yes.
Travel. Travel with me. If I say he's everything, that means he's everything. Is he here? He's here. Is he up there in that light bulb?
Yes.
He's everything. Is he in that little medallion around you, Matt?
Yes.
Or he's everything. Free. So an exercise. When you go out, somebody told me they saw a pack of wild turkeys this morning.
Yeah.
Is that God?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's God. That little creek that's running through the property. Is that God?
Yeah.
Everything. Freedom. So now I look for the lessons in everything. I don't do it perfectly. Sometimes I'm in it and I gotta stop myself. My old lady would say to me, why you ain't saying nothing? I said, I'll say because I'm not saying nothing. Well, at one time I wouldn't give. You with me? How can I be of service to you? Freeing stuff. Why? Because I must cultivate a relationship with a God personal to me. And it will come as a result of my experiences with living life. Ain't easy, folks. I ain't even talked about Mr. on 12th Street yet. He wants to run shit on me. Still, 31 years and a couple of days, he still wants to run shit. Still shows up. But something's happened now that when he shows up, I can spot him. That's why I don't say nothing to Helen when she's coming at me. Just see what you got to say. We'll talk later. Because there's times when what I'm going to say is about Mr. 12 years. I can't let him have the upper hand. You with me? So you begin to get what? You begin to get God consciousness as a result of this stuff. Why? Because you begin to cultivate a personal relationship with a God, understanding that what? He wants to be your buddy. He wants to be your friend. He wants you free. He don't want you to suffer no more. I perpetuate my own suffering. So you can believe or become willing to believe. And when you do that, you put your cornerstone in place. What's a cornerstone do? When they build a building, they put a cornerstone.
What?
Huh? Exactly. It's the first stone you put in building a structure. First stone usually has the name of the person and the date that they did it. It's a method to the madness. It's no way this book was written without divine intervention. They were guided by God in writing this book. Why? Look at the room. And the information touches everybody in here on a certain level. Look at the world. Alcoholics Anonymous is all over the world as a result of this book. We went to the AA store yesterday, right? Big books in every language you could think of. Only God could. You with me? So, God is either everything or nothing. So exercise when you leave. Today. When you're walking around and conversating and doing whatever you do, look for God in what you do. In your relationship, look for God. In the moment you want to get pissed off at somebody about something they say or the way they act, you might want to entertain the fact maybe they're just doing the best they can with what they got. They don't know no better. How can I help them? Support them. Know they're sick just like me. Last piece dealing with step two. Let T jump in if you've got anything to say. That little church taught me to look for God up in the sky somewhere, riding on clouds and stuff. Couldn't understand from that. Brought into it. But when they gave me this piece on 55 that says, actually we were fooling ourselves, but deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And I began to think about that. And I thought about that other book. And that other book said what? What did it say? Somebody talk to me.
God was unfair.
No. The other book, what does it say? It says that somewhat, but in the very beginning of the book, in the first chapter, it says what?
God created heaven
and earth, and God created what else?
Man.
Huh? Talk to me, it's okay. Man.
Man.
Right, and after he created man, what did he do?
Woman.
What did he do when he created man?
He himself.
Yeah, but what else did he do?
Blew
the breath of life into man, and life, man became a living creature. Right? Anybody else read that book besides me? Nobody else has read the Bible? Take a look at it sometime. Don't use it in place of this. Get this foundation first. Then springboard into some other stuff. But when I read this, I went back to that. And it made perfect sense. If God blew the breath of life into man, God ain't out there. God is in me. I no longer look for God up there no more. I look for God deep down within me. In every breath that I breathe, wake or sleep, God is with me. Gave me exercise. Take that God, that cultivation of a new conception as a result of what you wrote about, how do I think about God? Those adverse negative things, flip them. And flip them to, I'm willing to believe God is not a punishing God. I'm willing to believe God don't play favorites. I'm willing to believe God is more is not more of a part of this religion than this religion. On and on and on. I'm willing to believe God has no color. My God today has no color. He ain't black, he ain't white. I call him man, but how could God be a man? When I say man, automatically there's manly deals that I attach to that, right? He can't be that. But for lack of a better word, you with me? I begin to get a new conception that I'm willing to believe in and I can work with. And God begins to do exactly what he's wanted to do your entire lives. Why do you think you sit here this afternoon, this morning? Because you had something to do with it? Any mad dogs in here? Come on, y'all. Who's the mad dogs in here? Be honest, I ain't going to tell nobody. You sit here by the grace to God. Grace to God. One more time he spoke, and that time you listen. Even if you ain't doing what you need to do in the fellowship, meaning, why come through 12-step fellowship and not work through 12 steps? It's a twist. Why come through 12-step fellowship and not let the steps work you? Why not get free? Are you just hanging out? You just like what we do? Are you just abstinent? But miserable? We got people in the rooms that's miserable. Showing up to meeting after meeting after meeting. Come to the meeting fucked up, leave the meeting fucked up. Any sense? Make any sense?
Yeah.
It does make sense?
No.
No. No, you mean
that
don't matter. So here's the piece to end up the second step. The fundamental idea of God is in every man, woman, and child identify. Because they gave me the fundamental idea of God in that little church. That religious deal. Which was about exactly what we're about, a spiritual way of living life. It says with us, because we've become altered over the years, right? We've taken on this to live out here, and this to live out here, as opposed to living from in here, out here. It says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship, and of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. Anybody pray? Anybody pray? Don't raise your hand if you don't. Right. In some form or other, there's a belief in a power greater than you. If it wasn't, you wouldn't pray. It's there. How else do you know you have the ability to believe? You believed in, what did you do? Smith, okay?
Yeah.
Right. You believed in Smith, right? You believed when you took that one-on-one, right?
Right.
You have the capacity to believe. Every time I went and cop, put it in the cooker, cooked it up, stuck it in my arm, jacked it off, I did what?
I believed
that it was going to do what it needed to do. Believed in that for a long time. So why can't you believe that there's a power at work in this room right now? Right now. That can move your life to another level. You don't ever have to pick up again. You'll never have to pick up again. You just need to get on the path and stay on the path. This is the crux of being on the path. A willingness to believe. Not even believing, a willingness to believe. It said, for faith in a power greater than ourselves, the miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man. Here it is. We have the capacity to believe. Is it in your best interest to believe in something other than yourself? Does that need to happen for you? But everybody in here, that don't need to happen. I've talked about it. Everybody in the rooms don't need God to stay stopped. But I got to get out of that arena and just ask me, do I need God to stay stopped? Do I need a power greater than myself to keep me on a daily basis? To walk with me on a daily basis? To talk to me on a daily basis? Do I need that? I ain't worried about what you're doing. I'll help you find your way, but what do I need in order to recover? Recover. Get my life back. With some sense, some semblance of sanity. Why? Because I'm insane. It says, we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we had for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly. Step four. Search fearlessly. But he was there. It was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, is only there that he may be found. It was so with me. And I went looking for him in meditation. I tried him. Okay. So I need you to fix this, man. I talked to God. I talked to my God the same way I'll talk to T or Eric. You know, what's up with this, man? You know, what's happening with this? You know, and I'm still human. I'll be stuck in something for a while, and it's like, well, why am I here so long? Then the answer comes, because you ain't learned the lesson. And then I get content with the situation, and I know that he's going to show up. And you better not pick it up, Mike. Pick up what? The way you used to do things. Why? Because he got you to Cocaine Anonymous in this fellowship, in this big book, in this process. And my willingness to believe turns into a faith and a knowingness that God is. You too can have a miraculous life, an unbelievable life. And if you're like me, you didn't believe it could happen. All that stuff had to come back to me. I had forgot about all that stuff. Heron was my master. I had a love affair with Heron. And as I began to get on this path and do what they told me to do, Mark, Joe, GW, Shelley, and now Mr. C, my life is phenomenal. Phenomenal. That waits for you too. A phenomenal life. I don't know in what area to be phenomenal, but I guarantee it'll be phenomenal. The kids of the world will not dominate you anymore. We're dominated. Somebody said it earlier by 100 forms of fear. Fear is only me thinking that I can work something out. And there's a part of me that knows you can't fix this, Mike. You don't have the power. That's what this step two is about, the acquisition of power, that you can fix it or God will fix it for you. Last page on 57, it says, what is this but a miracle of healing? Miracle of healing. I get to discard. I get to shed some stuff in this second step that has blocked me from cultivating a relationship with a power greater than myself who's just waiting for you to come home. Just waiting. That's my deal. You get your own. If it works for you, you're welcome to share it with me. But you need to get one. If you're what? A what?
Mad.
A mad dog. That's right. If you're a mad dog, this is it. You can branch off into other stuff, but this is my foundation. I tell you I'm a licensed minister. This is my foundation, though. I got the opportunity to do that as a result of this. I don't put that before this.
Ooh. I can listen to Brother Mike here all day. That's magnificent. The consciousness of my belief in a power greater than myself did not come to me until step 9. I was willing to believe all through that stretch. I'm going to talk about this later as we get to step 9. This conception that Mike was describing, it removes the dualistic view of my relationship with God. And it brings me into this place where I see the unity that pervades all of existence. And it doesn't put me in a state of separation from God. Therefore, I never buy into this idea that there's some entity out there that just made a decision to bring this to me. I'm not that important. God doesn't stop what he's doing. And you know what? I'm going to fuck Tarek's day up today. This doesn't work like that for me because of exercises like this that I've done with Mike. I remember sitting in the basement of a treatment center. This is how simple it is. And I believe that individuals that debate when it gets to the second step, that don't have a willingness, they haven't been crushed by the self-imposed crisis in the first step. There's no surrender, so they're going to debate. I've yet to sponsor a guy who's experienced a surrender in the first step that argues with me about step 2. Usually they're like, yes, let's move. They want to move very quickly. They want to get through the process. I was sitting in the basement of a treatment center. It was a real the treatment center I was at was on this little lake, and there was a dock, and we had step study. We were reading the second step out of the 12 and 12. And I remember the way the birds were and the way the light was hitting the water and the breeze that day. I was sitting on a couch, and this guy, Andy, was leading the 12 step, the second step study. And he asked some questions. He's like, you know, the sun is shining, the wind's blowing, the birds are chirping. You know, there's something holding this all together so it doesn't fall apart. And he asked, do any of you have the power to do any of that? And of course, everybody sitting in the room is like, absolutely not. He said, well, are you willing to believe that there's a power greater than you that's allowing that to take place? How do you argue with that? You can't. The most magical part of the steps is your own conception, however inadequate is a starting place, and we can grow from there. And as my moral development progresses in my life, my conceptions of God continuously change. That's the freedom. I've always been blessed with this inquisitive, investigative curiosity about God. I have never latched on to any dogmatic views when it comes to this, and I have been free. The best definition of freedom that I've ever run across is the capacity to doubt and question everything that you see and have your own experience with it. I want to read a couple of things. Like, Mike had me do this exercise, so I don't do it with every guy I sponsor, but a couple of years ago, one guy I sponsored, we did this exercise, and this is what he came up with, and it's my conception of God as well. And it almost brought me to tears the first time I read it. And I'm not saying this is what you have to believe, but I'm going to give you an example of how exciting this exercise Mike has asked you guys to consider doing is. How do I think about God? Currently, God is reality. God is everything that is happening, will happen, and has ever happened in the eternal moment. In my current conception, the only difference between self-will and God's will is a matter of perception or separation, which the ego creates. In my current belief, self-will is a delusion because God's will is all there is anyway. For a human to believe that they are separate or have the power to alter God's will is a much conceited thought to me. God is moving me, talking through me, viewing through me, along with everyone else and everything else, all at the same time, eternally. Everything that has happened, will happen, and will ever happen, all under God's perfect grace. In the big book, it states God is everything. In another book, it says nothing acts but God. These statements are the most accurate statements as to our limited conception of God. Put quite simply, I am just the manifestation of God that we, with our human minds, call this individual's name. His name was Brandon, in an attempt to understand and limit so that it makes sense to us and we feel safe. I'm just along for the ride to play my role in God's show of creation. Paradoxically, I am responsible to the rest of this world for every action that I experience, for everything that I do or don't do. Through ownership of my actions is my faith in God deepened, knowing that I can stop worrying and trying to control the show, because everything has and always will work out without me having to do anything. And it just, that's how fun this stuff can be. I mean, that's a, some people would consider that a way out there conception. But it works. And, you know, I've watched this young man now for 8 years, and it's just fascinating when you see someone with a willingness to continuously change their mind. Now, I have another guy who's been a great influence in my life, and he's been sober about 50 years, and he says he's appalled by the amount of things he's had to change his mind about in 50 years. Yeah. All right? One more thing I want to read. And then we're going to break. You just got anything you want to read too?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. I'm going to read this. It comes from a little meditation book I stumbled across. It's called A Basket of Fresh Bread. And it goes with page 55. Page 55 tells you how you're going to find God, when you're going to find God, and where you're going to find God. There is a basket of fresh bread on your head, yet you go door to door asking for crusts or crumbs. Knock on the inner door, no other door. Sloshing knee-deep in clear stream water, you keep wanting a drink from other people's water bags. Water is everywhere around you, but you see only barriers that keep you from water. A horse is moving beneath the rider's thighs, yet he still asks, "Where's my horse?" Right there, under you. Yes, that's a horse, but where's the horse? Can't you see? Yes, I can see, but whoever saw such a horse? Mad with thirst, he cannot drink from the stream running so close by his face. He is like a pearl on the deep bottom, wondering inside the shell, where is the ocean? His mental questionings form the barrier. His physical eyesight bandages his knowing. Self-consciousness plugs his ears. Stay bewildered in God, and only that. You know, as this weekend progresses, we're going to ask you questions that will make you question some of the things that you believe. Is the great reality deep down within? That's an important question. Do you believe that? And Mike and I, you know, we have been blessed and tapped into endless stream or river. And what we're doing this weekend is we're going to the river and we're bringing these handfuls of water to you. But what we're really saying is go to the river. Go to the river. It's available. Mike and I aren't special. You know, this has been our path has led us here, but we've been led here to touch a few of you. But, you know, if our past experience is any indicator of this current experience, parts of it, that we're not here to talk to all of you. But somebody here is going to hear something this weekend, and it's going to tap a chamber of your heart that has been untapped thus far. And that makes this trip worthwhile for Mike and I.
So before we break for a couple minutes break, and then we have lunch, right?
No, we got one more session. We have another session.
Yeah, but we're going to take a break and come back before lunch.
Yeah.
Right? Right. Cahil Gibran. Cahil Gibran is one of my favorite authors. I have all of his books, and one of them is The Tear and the Smile. And there's a piece in here that's entitled The Spirit. And the God of God separated the spirit from himself and created in it beauty. He gave to it the lightness of the breeze at dawn and the fragrance of the flowers of the field and the softness of moonlight. Then he gave to it a cup of joy, saying, "You shall not drink of it except that you forget the past and heed not the future." And he gave to it a cup of sadness, saying, "You shall drink and know therefrom the meaning of life's rejoicing." Then he put therefore therein a love that will forsake it with the first sight of satisfaction, and a sweetness that would go out therefrom with the first word uttered. And he caused to descend upon it knowledge from the heavens to guide it in the way of truth, and planted in its depths sight, that it might see the unseen. Therein he created feeling to flow with images and phantom forms, and clothed it with a garment of yearning woven by angels from rainbow strands. In it he did put the darkness of confusion, which is light's image. And the God took fire from wrath's furnace, and a wind from the desert of ignorance, and sand from the seashore of selfishness, and earth from beneath the feet of the ages, and he created man. He gave to him unseeing force to rise up in fury with madness, and subside before lust. And the God of God smiled and wept and knew a love boundless and without limit. And he made it man with his spirit. 10-minute break.
Just come back a quarter after. Let's come back a quarter after, and then we'll go to lunch.